This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Fred Skepsy, directed the film IQ, a romantic comedy about Albert Einstein rescuing his niece from marrying an intelligent boor, leading her instead into the arms of an auto mechanic with heart. Our film critic, Stephen Schiff, has his reservations about the new film, but in a 1993 profile, he described Skepsy as probably the least known great director working in the mainstream American cinema. Skepsy also directed the films 6 Degrees of Separation, The Russia House, A Cry in the Dark, Roxanne, and The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith. He grew up in Melbourne, Australia, and now divides his time between Melbourne and the U.S. The Australian film industry has made its impact on Hollywood. Little Women is directed by Australian Gillian Armstrong. Driving Miss Daisy was directed by Australian Bruce Beresford. The Australian film Priscilla, Queen of the Desert was an art house hit in 1994. Skepsy was one of the directors who led the way as part of the Australian New Wave of the 70s. I asked him what changed in the 70s.
Australian film had really come to a standstill. We made a lot of films in the 40s and then up to the mid-50s, and somewhere in the mid-50s it all stopped dead. And there are a number of reasons for that. Budgets, international selling of film, and then a stranglehold that both the English and the Americans got on our exhibition and distribution system. And I mean a real stranglehold. In a way, we were locked out of our theaters. And I think that the systems or the studios that were set up were somehow waiting for things to come to them rather than initiating them. And it took a new generation, if you like, to come through to start that process again. And I guess, you know, we were youthful, exuberant and ignorant and arrogant and all those things and just cut through the mess and went for it. We didn't know how much trouble we could get into.
Did you lose a lot of money?
I didn't get rich out of it, shall we say. No, on one film I did okay. On the other film I lost everything, so... But to do it, you know, like when I was doing Devil's Playground, for instance... I raised half the money myself, and then I had to raise that much money again to release it because nobody here wanted to release it. So I hired my own cinemas and did the whole advertising campaign with some friends of mine, and we, you know, exhibited and distributed it ourselves. And when Australians went in to see the films, they liked them. The other thing is, you know, that is often not credited for what happened in Australian film, is that television came in here in 1956, and thanks to some sensible government regulations insisting on a certain amount of local material, we had our own program starting to come through in the early 60s, so that particularly for the latter half of the 60s, there were quite a few, even though there were imitation cop shows and things, there were quite a few Australian programs and some kind of original comedies and some wonderful review shows, and Australians stopped becoming embarrassed about seeing themselves on screen. In fact, they started to like it. What they found as they started to watch television is that they liked to see the action taking place on their own streets, that they understood that it wasn't unglamorous to see, you know, your real world up on screen in the way you'd been seeing the worlds of America or England or France or other places. And I think that sort of took away some of our embarrassment. Now, incidentally, some of this is also caused, you know, by a lot of our films for a while were not well acted. And I think it helped take that away too, you know, that there was a consistency, a standard coming out. I remember the day that Peter Weir's film, Picnic at Hanging Rock, was released, and I drove into the city to see, you know, what was going to happen. And there were queues for 4 blocks. Now, there really hadn't been an enormous amount of publicity, but there was something in the air about that film. And you could tell right there that Australians just wanted to see their own history, their own culture, their own voice on screen, finally, and they queued up for weeks to do it, and it was the most exciting thing I'd seen.
One of your early films, The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith, was based on something that happened in Australian history. It's set at the turn of the century and was about a man who's half Aboriginal and who tries to assimilate into white society. And when everything overwhelms and frustrates him, he kind of goes on a rampage and massacres several white people. What reaction did you get to that part of, to that story from Australian history? Was that what people wanted to see?
Nope. Unfortunately.
Is that the movie you lost everything?
That's the one I lost the money on. there is a fantastic film just been made in New Zealand called Once Were Warriors, which I had the good fortune to see a couple of days ago. Now, in New Zealand, that's apparently enormously successful. About two-thirds of all New Zealanders have been to see it. You know, it's a film that's a modern version of Jimmy Blacksmith, if you like. It's about what happened to the Maori society and how violent their lives are and how violent their personal relationships are. So I don't know what the difference was. Maybe people just weren't ready for it here. When Jimmy Blacksmith came out, the violence in Jimmy Blacksmith is very anti-violence. And so it happens when you least expect it to the people you'd least want it to happen to. And it's very quick. And that upset a lot of people. In fact, on the major morning newspaper in Melbourne, they wrote an article just about that violence starting on the second page, and it ran the whole third and fourth page of the paper. And, you know, it was things like that happened all around the country that I think kept people away from the film. They were too frightened to go and see it.
If you lost everything on the movie The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith, why did you make another film? What gave you the courage? And where'd you get the money?
Well, I told you we were brash, young, arrogant, and stupid. no, I went to America shortly after that because I couldn't afford to do it anymore. So I had a kind of an idea that if I went to America and maybe made a name for myself making films there, that would help me to, you know, do more with Australian films and get a better release because I'd be known a bit more. And also I wanted to test myself against that system to see what it had to offer, what that kind of filmmaking could do. If I incorporated it in what I did. And then you get, then you get caught up in a different set of problems, don't you?
Yeah, well, I'm interested in how you reacted to that different set of problems. You know, you were working very independently in Australia, no big film system to back you up, you were losing your own money. And then you come to America and you're working with the American system, which, as you say, has problems of its own. How did you fit in?
It took a while. I had written something, and I don't think it was mainstream enough. I don't think it was quite understood enough. What I did find was that, in general, in America and the major studio mainstream, people say they want you for your originality, but what they really want you for is to freshen up the genres that they make pictures in. And so I found myself doing, for instance, it's a longer story than this because there were six or seven projects involved before I did Barbarossa, but I found myself doing a Western because people thought Jimmy Blacksmith was a great Western. Now, I never for one second considered Jimmy Blacksmith to have anything to do with being a Western. And I think I find that's the hardest thing, is that people want to sort of stay in the narrowness of a genre and are frightened if you try and do the unexpected, because they go through a thing called a preview process. And the preview process, you know, is where you give audience cards that are like a foolscap sheet with questions on both sides and almost suggestions as to how you answer, and you suddenly turn somebody who's just had hopefully a spellbinding experience and should be in a semi-hypnotic state if you've done it well enough, you're suddenly asking them to be rational about strictly emotional things, and you get them to say what they liked and what they didn't like, etc. And you know, you put a lot of things in a film that you don't want people to like. So if they write down they don't like it, that's successful. But then what you see people doing is they read that in when they summarize the preview cards, and they want that out of the film. Anything that's slow, anything that doesn't move fast enough, doesn't have enough overt action or whatever, you know, you suddenly find people want it out of the film. If you've built up a character that you want people to like, and then he's going to die because that's going to make you hate somebody else, etc., that upsets the audience, so they want that out of the film, you know. And certainly on my first couple of films, Barbarossa and Iceman, the preview process made them lesser films than they really were.
My guest is Australian film director Fred Skepsey. His films include IQ, 6 Degrees of Separation, The Russia House, and A Cry in the Dark. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Australian film director Fred Skepsey. I think my favorite of your films is 6 Degrees of Separation. And that was adapted from a John Gare play. And in the movie, Will Smith from Fresh Prince of Bel-Air starred as a young man who's impersonating, he's pretending that he passes himself off as Sidney Poitier's son. And he basically insinuates himself into the lives of some very wealthy people and puts on what turns out to be quite a performance for them because they're totally fooled by this identity that he's put on. I thought Will Smith really gave an excellent performance in the film, but I was wondering if he was cast because he was on a studio list or because if you knew that he'd be giving such a fine performance. You know what I mean? Sometimes the studios...
No, I know exactly what you mean.
...tell you who you have to cast in order to get the money to make the film.
Well, here's the truth of it. Will Smith had just done a film with Arnon Milchan in San Francisco. It's the one with, I think, Whoopi Goldberg and Ted Danson. Mm-hmm. Where he was a test tube baby and wanted to find his father. Anyway, they had liked him so much, and they liked his television success, that he, in fact, was the money hook, that if we got Will to be in the film, then we would definitely get the money. It gave them a marketing hook that they didn't feel they otherwise had. Particularly if we were going with Stockard Channing, you know, who's an absolutely wonderful actress, but not that well known in the world of film. It wasn't then a case of us going out and saying, "Righto, Will, you've got the job." You know, he came with one of the people from Arnon Milchan's company, dressed up very well, which he doesn't normally do, and trying to be that person, and he really presented himself. And showed himself to be willing also to go through what I felt was a necessary training process before we did it. I was very impressed with him, but it didn't stop there. I did actually interview something like 15 other major actors, and he won the part just as much on his ability and his persona as he did on being a name. And then he went to see the play, he went to see it in Los Angeles, and then I took him across to England to see it there and to see how differently it could be done. And then he underwent a 12-week training program, both with an actor's coach and with a dialect coach, working on exercises and learning how to talk like an educated person from Philadelphia. And he, you know, he went through that very, very seriously. And then we used to get together once a week and see what stage he was at. And depending what stage he was at, we would then go through one or two scenes and talk about the various approaches that could be taken with those scenes and try different things so that he got a real healthy understanding that there was more than one way to look at it, and that what was being said sometimes had very little to do with what was actually going on. Mm-hmm. And he was, he was, I can't tell you how dedicated he was to it.
Yeah, I really thought it was a fine performance. I have read, there's a scene in the film, it turns out that the character is gay. And there's a scene in the film where he comes on to a young straight man and kisses him. And as it turns out, Will Smith was really uncomfortable doing that, so uncomfortable that I think he asked you if he could do the scene without the kiss. Did you have any idea he'd have that reaction?
No, we talked about that up front, right up front. It was almost one of the first things. I said, you have to do this, 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 and this in the film. Are you going to be able to do that? Will you do that? He lied. No, he was very keen, you know, to get the job. I think the truth is, as the time came nearer, you know, Will's from a pretty macho world. And he was under a lot of pressure as well within his own world, rightly or wrongly. You know, let's forget political correctness for a moment. You know, there's his own version of political correctness from within his own circle of people. And there was a lot of pressure, believe it or not, from people on Will to not do this because they see him as a role model and they didn't think, you know, again, rightly or wrongly, that this was what a role model in the black community should be doing.
So how did you resolve this with him?
We did a lot of talking about it, and, you know, I just kept trying to put it into its proper perspective, that it really, you know, that perhaps he was being forced into a distorted point of view and letting it get out of proportion, and that he was an actor, and, you know, and also that film is an illusion and there's a way of creating what you need without always having to do it. Something that seems to be forgotten sometimes in film.
So how did you shoot the kiss?
Cleverly. you know, it's shot in a way that it looks like it's happening and it feels like it's happening, and it isn't necessarily.
So he never really came
around? But a couple of times it is. Yeah, no, he did it.
Well, I thought you said it looks like it's happening, but it's not really happening.
Well, he does it in some scenes and not in others.
Right, okay. I know your first film, The Devil's Playground, was based on some of your experiences, I believe, as in a Roman Catholic boarding school and in a seminary?
It's a monastery. Yeah.
Monastery, yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
So were there movies that you really wanted to see that you weren't allowed to see because of your religious training?
Yeah, absolutely.
And did that make it even more exciting, the thought of movies and making movies?
Ingmar Bergman's, I think it's One Summer of Happiness. I might have this wrong now, but there was a film that was on the list, shall we say. Have you ever heard of that? I think you have that in America.
Right, this is the list of movies you're not supposed to see.
Yeah, but it's called The List. You know, it's like a title that means, you know, if you go, you're committing a mortal sin. I don't know who decided this. And there was a certain kind of thing, you know, you can get excommunicated and all that sort of stuff if you did this wrongly or too often or something. And so I went to see this film, which was on the list, knowing full well what it meant. And I thought it was going to be because of the sexuality, of which there was so little, that from that point of view I was disappointed. However, I saw a really fantastic film. So when I came out afterwards, I went, well, why was that on the list? Why have I got into, you know, all this sort of moral trouble because of this? And it turns out that they were satirizing priests, satirizing the country priests. And I hadn't even noticed.
Yeah.
I said, you're kidding me. I couldn't believe it. So there was an attraction because of that, I guess. But actually, I was quite lucky. Like in the seminary, there was an extraordinary, the man was a Marist brother, not the seminary, the monastery. The man was a Marist brother, and you know, they used to get films in, but this man, you know, taught Latin and English and geography and stuff. He was a highly intelligent man who had you know, who loved great literature and loved films that reflected great literature. So we actually got exposed to some quite terrific films because of him. You know, now I'm 13 at this time, you have to remember. And, you know, for instance, on Saturday nights, this man would teach us about music, and every Saturday night he would take a different instrument, and, you know, he would have our sort of common room covered with drawings and photographs and things of that instrument, and then play great orchestral pieces. And our instructions were not to listen to the whole music, but to listen only to that instrument and what its role was within the whole. And things like that. I mean, the man was an incredibly stimulating person, and you know, I think that had that helped me personally a lot to do what I'm doing now.
Fred Skepsy, his latest film is IQ. He spoke to us from Australia. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.